The story tonight is an extraordinary one. As a lightie, I remember one of my favorite movies was called The Battle of Britain. Did anyone see that movie? Okay, I don't know why you liked it, but for me it was that the tail gunner who got shot in the eyes and the tomato sauce spurted out. Do you remember that? That to me was, whoa, that was like big story. Anyway, the guy who it was based on, the hero, is the man we're going to talk about tonight. How cool is that? He is Dr. Yvonne Milan's grandpa's cousin. And she's going to tell us in a moment why she went into so much detail on him. But I also looked up before today about Sailor Milan. And I asked Grok, because Grok's much better than ChatGPT, by the way. I asked Grok, who were the best pilots in the Battle of Britain? Now remember, the Battle of Britain was that part of the Second World War when up to that point the Germans had never lost any battle. In fact, I think that it was 1943 or something before they lost their first battle. But this was in 1941, and they were just steamrolling through the fascists. And those who defended this little island of Britain, the idea was, well, no, I'm not going to say anymore because everyone will tell me I'm wrong. But what I do want to tell you is that Winston Churchill said, never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. And that's why they call the pilots of the Battle of Britain the few. And the three top pilots in the Battle of Britain were Sailor Milan, Johnny Johnson, and Eric Locke. Sailor Milan, South African boy, who then came back and did some extraordinary things here, and you wonder, had history been different, how different our country would be. That's teeing up Yvonne, who is a passionate historian, an advocate for South Africa's unsung hero, not surprisingly, her relative. She was born in Somerset West. Her academic journey took her from Stellenbosch University to Oxford University, where she had a doctorate, and then she got a postdoctorate from Harvard. So this is no ordinary dude sitting next to me here, or no ordinary at all. She's going to share the story of one of the RAF's most outstanding Spitfire pilots, Sailor Milan, South African legend of World War II. Battle of Britain movie was about 74 Squadron, and he was the leader of 74 Squadron, of which Yvonne is an honorary member. Now, the Brits really do take their history pretty seriously. Sailor shot down 27 enemy aircraft, earned a Distinguished Service Order and a Distinguished Flying Cross. 27, for context, the British ace who did the most shot down 34. So he was the second biggest British ace. Of course, the Germans had guys who shot down 100, but let's not go there. You remember? Anyway, let's not go there. Coming back home, he led the Torch Commando against apartheid's rise in the 1950s. And he was one of the leaders in that organization, because when they came back from overseas where they had served with people of all races and all colors, these servicemen said, but this is crazy. Why are you saying one race is superior to another, or one should be going in this line and the other? There were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who followed them. Yvonne again is going to be telling us much more about that, so I will stop. She has spent years championing his legacy, including running marathons and giving lectures worldwide to raise funds for the Spitfire Society, of which she is the patron and the vice president. Yvonne is also the patron and vice president of the Hornchurch Aerodrome Historical Trust and ambassador of the National Spitfire Memorial. What a treat to have you with us. Thank you. So tell us about your relationship. When did you first realize what a great guy Sailor was?
Well, growing up in South Africa, he's not that well known. So obviously I knew I was related to him, and I actually knew more about his Torch Commando career before I knew more about his RAF career. But studying in the UK, I played a lot of cricket, so if people see your name on the scorecard, they say Milan. That's a Milan they know. It's not thankfully not DF Milan. It's Sailor Milan. So, for example, when I met Sir Roger Bannister for the first time, his first question was, are you related to the bad guy or the good guy? because Bannister, he was a schoolboy during the Second World War, and he idolized these pilots. So in the UK, it's very common for people to come up to me and say, oh, and either my grandfather flew with him or my father was in the ground crew. And he's a much loved figure. And what's interesting about him and also about 74 Squadron is he was very strict about the reason he didn't join the Navy. He didn't like the hierarchy. That's why he joined the RAF. And so when he was a group captain and when he commanded 74 Squadron, he was very strict. I don't care if you're a pilot or the ground crew. The pilots, you don't get to be rude to the ground crew or the people who keep you up in the air. We're all equal. And there are incidents I've heard of where pilots threw tantrums at ground crew, and he said to them, do that again, you're gone. So he was also speaking to members of 74 Squadron and also the historian and archivist. It was very rare for an officer to be loved like that by all the members of the squadron. Yeah, so it was interesting that you didn't hear from people whose family members were pilots but ground crew. They remember the name because he was very much adored. And as the official historian of 74 Squadron told me, that's very rare. When he did research about the squadron, it was very rare for a commanding officer to be so loved. He said that he used the word loved by everybody in the squadron.
How did he end up in the Royal Air Force, being a South African?
Well, he was, if you run a bit, his life is full of little twists and turns. A lot of things happened in his life. He could easily have ended up being Adolf Milan from Wellington, never been well known. But when he's 13 years old, just before that, his father loses the family farm. And father has a mental breakdown. They move around. They eventually settle in Wellington. His mother keeps the family afloat by taking in boarders. And if his father had not lost the farm as the firstborn son, he would have become a farmer. But they lose the farm. They're in big financial trouble. They see advertisement in the newspaper saying they're taking cadets in Simonstown aboard the General Botha training ship. And they need a quota of Afrikaans and English boys. And because he's in Milan, he's Afrikaans speaking, his parents say, well, that's one less mouth to feed. Off you go. And when he's 14 years old, the family moves to the Eastern Cape, and he's pretty much on his own. And if you've read anything about the General Botha training ship, it's very harsh discipline. They get flogged for the smallest offenses. He's all by himself. And that influences his life in two ways. The one is he learns a lot of practical skills, which stayed him in good stead in the RAF. But he also, from a young age, he had a very acute sense of right and wrong and justice and fairness. And when faced with all his bullying and hazing, he says, I'm not going to be like that. So it solidifies his sense of justice. And he never, for the rest of his life, he never likes a bully, whether it's Nazis or the National Party. That's just part of who he is. So he joins the Merchant Navy at about 18. And because of the Great Depression, he can't really progress through the ranks. So he joins the Royal Navy Reserve, and that's where the nickname Sailor came from. Initially, his nickname was Admiral, because I thought he was in the Royal Navy, but then they found out it was Wavy Navy, the Navy Reserve, and that demoted him to Sailor. So that's where the nickname comes from. But he doesn't like the hierarchy in the Navy, and because as a sailor he visited German ports, he knows war is coming. And what's interesting, someone who was in Germany in the same time as he was visiting the German ports was Brom Fischer, who was a student at Oxford. So Fischer goes on a tour through Germany and the Soviet Union.
Just explain for those who don't know who Brom Fischer was.
Brom Fischer was the advocate at the Ravania trial, the lead counsel, and he was later sentenced to life imprisonment, and he died in 1975 as a prisoner. He came from.
He was also the He was also the son of, was it the
judge president or the free? He came from a very established, very privileged family, very Afrikaner power, Afrikaner establishment. His grandfather was in the cabinet in the old Orange Free Trade Republic, and his father was a judge president. He was a Rhodes Scholar. So at the same time, Fischer, who's insulated by all this privilege in his life, he goes to Germany and he sees the Nazis going, rise of the Nazi party, and he says, oh, well, you know, and it's kind of ironic given how his life turned out. He says, you know, if the Nazis, if it makes them happy, if this makes the Germans happy, then, you know, who are we to complain? Sailor, who's not insulated by any privilege, who sees injustice close up, he says, war is coming and I need to do something. So he joins the Royal Air Force. And another twist in his life, he was actually too old to join the RAF, but because the RAF was going through a rebuilding phase, they changed the age requirements and he's allowed to join. So all this small little twist in his life, he could easily turn out differently.
Did he always want to fly Spitfires?
Well, he was asked to bring the first Spitfires of St. Vincent 4 Squadron to their base, and he never flew anything else. He just fell in love, and that was it.
And what was so special about the Spitfires?
Well, what's not special about a Spitfire? Have you ever heard that Merlin engines? I mean, it's a beautiful aircraft. It was a fantastic fighter. Unlike the Hurricane, it was basically a gun platform. Like Sailor said, she's a bitch on the ground, but she's a lady in the air. And he also said you can fly until your eyes pop out off, but, you know, the wings will stay on. And it's just a beautiful aircraft. Even though we're Hurricanes in the squadron, he never flew anything else.
And what made a good fighter pilot? What made him a natural and such a great a pilot and air ace?
Well, he had fantastic reflexes, brilliant hand-eye coordination, and growing up on a farm, he was used to deflection shooting. So he was an incredible shot, and you hear that from people who knew him after the war as well. He used to go hunting with him. Said this guy, his eyesight and his hand-eye coordination was just outstanding. And he ended up writing what RAF still use to this day, the 10 rules for air fighting.
Just explain that.
He wrote, when he was a commanding officer, he started writing these 10 rules for air fighting, like going close and don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. Long list of technical things like that. But also, one of the rules is something that kind of governed his life, and that is always turn and face the attack. And that was kind of his life philosophy, to be honest.
And the medals that he won, how did he win them? What was the inscription underneath them?
Well, he's kind of extraordinary in the fact that he flew during the Battle of Dunkirk. He flew right through the Battle of Britain, when people's life expectancy was measured in weeks. Well, just think about that for a second. And he also commanded the Free French on D-Day. So he saw quite a lot. At one stage, they withdrew him and sent him to America to go on a tour and encourage the Americans to join the war effort and teach them tactics, because they're worried about him getting shot down. But he flew something like 200 combat missions in his first year, including going up alone at night to shoot down bombers. So he saw a lot of action.
What's a combat mission? Just 200 in a year, 200 out of 365. It sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, sometimes we go up in the morning and go up in the afternoon again, so especially during the Battle of Britain.
So. But so what was it? How long was it typically?
Well, the Spitfire could, I think it's about 90 minutes if you could stay airborne. So it was a very limited period they could really fight, which is where his rules of air fighting came in as well, saying don't waste your ammunition, get close, always attack from the sun, things like that. But that, in the actual fact, was if you think they had to fly, where they had to fly from, is a very short space for actual aerial combat, for dogfights.
Yvonne, it's hard for us now to imagine how people must have felt at that stage, because you had this juggernaut in Europe that was taking over and just couldn't seem to have any resistance or meet any resistance. Did he ever write about that, about how they felt, that what you know, a little bit like what we heard from Oskar Cherubsky today. You know, the odds are so much against the guy, and yet his mind is so strong that he was supposed to die 5 years ago, and he's still, as we see, still very strong. Was there anything like that with Saylor?
He wasn't much of a letter writer, and he didn't keep a journal. And a lot of the interviews that he did during the war was obviously for propaganda. But what he did say is they were very much under the impression that they were the spearhead, they being the theory. And if they failed, that would be the end of democracy as we know it. So no pressure. But he was very much aware of that, and the people under him as well.
Do you think they were right, that it would have been the end of democracy? You're a historian, and you've studied all of this.
Well, I think if they lost the Battle of Britain, it would have been disastrous. And what we need to keep in mind, especially in this country, is regardless of when or where you were born in the world, if they had lost, it would have had consequences for you. And I think we should do a lot more in this country to celebrate the few and to celebrate the greatest generation. Because there were quite a few South Africans who fought. There were a couple of Victoria Cross recipients as well. So we can't just ignore the fact that that was a crucial battle. And that men and women from all races and backgrounds, Polish and Jamaica, flew in the Battle of Britain. There's this famous photo of Saylor Milan standing to Vincent Bunting, who's a pilot from Jamaica. So people tend to see this as an imperial war, whatever, but that's absolute nonsense, because the consequences would have been dire regardless of where you were in the world. And again, the people who flew and who kept the planes in the air were men and women from all kinds of backgrounds and races across the Commonwealth and from across the world.
So let's just take an alternative that the few had lost. What was the next step for Goering or for the German, for the Luftwaffe?
Well, then they would have owned the English Channel. And unless the Americans changed their minds very drastically, I think that could have well been it. So
that would have been an invasion of Britain by the Germans, and yeah, that would have been game over.
It's like Dunkirk, but just 10 times worse.
Yeah. We forget that. We forget the odds that were at play there. And did he ever talk about, or did he ever tell anyone about what it felt like to shoot down another human being when you are a soldier? Of course, it's your job, but it doesn't mean that you don't think about it afterwards.
I think the one thing he wrote about it is he said being in a dogfight was like being in a dark room with a madman with a knife. That's how scary it was. But he never, ever spoke about the war. He did suffer from pretty severe PTSD after the war, but that was mostly because he felt acutely responsible for the people under his command who died in war. Because he said there were young pilots who came in and he could see this guy's not going to last 2 weeks. And some of them for such a short period, they didn't even have photos of them. And many of them have no known grave that they were shot on over the English Channel. So that weighed quite heavily on him. But he never really spoke about the war. And to the extent that when he lived in Kimberley later life, when people mentioned the war, he would get up and leave. And when people would call him a hero, he would get very uncomfortable. And he would always deflect attention away from himself, saying, listen, I was one of thousands. There were infantrymen. There were people in the Navy. There were people who kept planes in the sky. You know, I was just one of many.
Sounds like an extraordinary humble man. Did he have a deep faith that took him on that path?
Religiously, no. But I think he had a very, very strong moral compass. And that comes from what I said, in an early age, he had a very strong sense of justice. And also, if you think he was an Afrikaans-speaking boy in an English environment, then he was an Afrikaans guy who joined the RAF. Also much older than most of the pilots. And when he joined the Torch Commando, he was one of the few guys of Afrikaner heritage, was a leader. So he was also kind of always an outsider in his life. And instead of that making him a cruel or mean character, he always, that in gave me the idea of where the fault lines of injustice lay. So his outsider status he always used for good purposes to some extent.
Before we move to his role in South Africa, did he ever meet Jan Smuts or Winston Churchill during the war? Was he that famous that they would want to see him?
Yes, he met Churchill, and Churchill was actually the godfather to his son. And Churchill took a great liking to him. And when Smuts came to Chequers, he would invite Sailor over to talk about the war. And he took his advice seriously and would ask, what do you think of these tactics, for example? And as also, if you contrast him with like a guy like Brom Fisher, who, especially in his early life, cruised through life on his family name, he got a foot in the door with those guys because of his strength of his character and what he did during the war. And it was quite poignant when he passed away in 63. Churchill, who was quite old at that stage, wrote a letter of condolence to the family and to Jonathan specifically. And he wasn't that close to Smuts, but he knew him. But he was quite close to Churchill.
So he's demobbed, presumably after the war, and comes back home. Tell us the story from there.
Okay, so he could have easily stayed in the UK. He was famous. He could have picked any job he wanted. But during the war, they moved house nearly 30 times. So he wants to come back to South Africa, raise his children. He had two young children. And an absolute chance meeting, he meets Harry Oppenheimer. And Harry says, come work for him. Harry was also a war veteran who could easily have avoided the front line. His father tried to keep him away from combat, and he purposely pursued it. So the two of them, despite being from vastly different backgrounds, they just click. And Harry says, come work for me, because if you stay in the RAF, you're going to fly a desk. And that's not for Sailor. And he wants, like I said, he had PTSD, wants to come home. So he comes back to South Africa, moves to Joburg, and he works as a personal political secretary to Harry Oppenheimer. Harry Oppenheimer becomes a member of parliament, so he has a very up-close view of what's going on in South African politics, especially in 1948. At some point, he says to Harry, listen, I can't do this job anymore. He needs space. He needs to go do something else. So Harry Oppenheimer was extraordinary. This is a really extraordinary friendship. He says, what do you want to do? And he says, I want to farm. So he gives him a De Beers farm near Kimberley, close to the Free State border, called Benfontein. And he becomes a farmer. And for the first time in his life, he's actually in one spot for more than 5 minutes. And he's finally found peace. And he says, I like the skies just plain blue with no comment. But then 1948 happens, and there's a group of veterans that started, some of them were in the Springbok Legion, which was started to become a front for the Communist Party. So others split off and formed the War Veterans Association. And people are worried, will they also be infiltrated by the Communist Party? We need a strong leader. So Harry Oppenheimer, who funded the Torch Commander, that's what they became, he goes to Sailor and he says, won't you lead them? Now at this stage, after everything he's been through, if Sailor turned around and said, listen, buddy, are you nuts? No. I think no one would have held it against him. But once again, it's his character and turn and face the attack. But not only that, the motto of 74 Squadron was, I fear no man. And that's kind of sums up Sailor's life. So he says, okay, I'll do it. And he becomes the president of the Torch Commander, and he's very effective because he's charismatic, he's a war hero. I mean, he's a good-looking guy, straight from Central Casting. You can't taint him and say he's a communist. He can speak Afrikaans. And the Nats start to worry about the Torch Commander because they're drawing a lot of young South Africans who otherwise wouldn't be political. And if you look, the war veterans who joined the Torch Commander, that once they had 250,000 members. Now, if you look at the white population of that area, that's a significant amount of people. 60% of them are Afrikaans-speaking. How many of you knew that? It's written out of South African history. And all of them are what you mentioned earlier. They're driven by this, we just fought against fascism, and now it's in our backyard. So you've got this diverse group of people. Some of them were privates. Some of them were senior officers. One guy was a guy called General Jimmy Durant, who was head of the South African Air Force before he was booted out by the National Party. Another guy is a guy called Justice De Wet. His son was Quartus De Wet, presided over the Rivania trial. Someone else is a guy called Dolph De La Rey, who's the cousin of General Koos De La Rey, who was in the Anglo-Boer War, and who, ironically, was the man who caught Churchill during the Anglo-Boer War. So there's another Churchill connection. And they have some of the largest anti-apartheid rallies in South African history. I mean, who knows about that? Nobody. And they've, most of the rallies are on Joburg. And at one point, the Nats say, to say, kind of hint to Saylor, you won't say, call us fascists to our faces. And Saylor has this hold my beer moment. And they all drive down to Cape Town in a massive convoy. And they hold a rally where the City Hall is today. And you all know the Mandela statue in City Hall. That is where Saylor stood a long time ago and led one of the largest anti-apartheid rallies in history. And what's quite funny, there's a famous photo of him taken at that rally, leaning down, shaking the hands of black members of the Torch Commando because it was a non-racial movement. And this photo was used in the international press. And the Afrikaans media is like, it's outrageous. He not only shook the hand of one black man, but three. So that is the reaction you get from the Afrikaans press. And National Party supporters violently break up these rallies. But they keep going. But that's a part of South African history that's not known. They were non-racial. Not all the branches applied it, though. Saylor was the one pushing for we allow anyone who's a veteran to join. And they also allowed non-veterans to join, but they weren't allowed to have positions of leadership. But then one of the other Torch Commando leaders, won't mention his name, he says if we allowed black members, they're going to call us communists. And so there's a split within the Torch Commando. It really tears them apart. Saylor on the one side and some of the others on the other side saying we can't allow black members. So eventually they allow the branches to decide by themselves. And most of the branches that were interracial were in the Cape. And someone who played a big role in that was Colin Eglin, who was later a member of parliament. And another...
explain a little more about Colin Eglin for the younger people.
He was a member of the Progressive Federal Party, an opposition party during apartheid. So many of the people who ended up in parliament via what was now the DA were very active in the Torch Commando. Someone like Michael Corbett, who later became Chief Justice, he was a prominent member. Vic Clapman Jr., the son of the founder of the Comrades Marathon, he was a member. So you've got a very interesting broad mix of people who were members of Torch Commando.
How come the Torch Commando didn't take over?
Well, a few reasons. The one is the different provinces pull in different directions. For example, the Natal branch didn't want Afrikaners in the Torch Commando.
Hang on, I suppose it is Natal.
Anyway.
Last outpost and all that, yeah.
It's only good for the Comrades Marathon, sorry. And some of them wanted an armed struggle, which Saylor was very much against, because he said, we've seen what war does. I'm not doing that again. And the other thing he said was, if you start an armed struggle, what are you going to unleash? Is it going to be far worse than what's going on now? And lastly, especially some of the white members of the Communist Party, he was very skeptical about them. He said, these guys want power. They don't want equality. They want power. So he was quite astute about certain things. So that's one of the reasons I wrote. They pull in different directions. They have different agendas. The non-racialism issue also becomes a problem. And also what happens when they start growing to 250,000 members. The Nats ban members of the civil service, judiciary, and armed services from joining, which was the bulk of their membership. So
this right on this, so the National Party government, this is the apartheid government post-48, they saw this as such a threat that they said, if you become a member of the Torch Commando, we're going to fire you.
Yeah.
You don't have your job on the railways or wherever else it might be. And if 60% of the members were Afrikaners, presumably a big chunk of those would have been working for the public sector.
Yes.
So using the instruments of state for political ends is nothing new in this country. So what happened? What happened after that?
So they start to unravel because of this. And they also, some of them say we should stay non-political, we just be a movement Some say we should turn into a political party. And people go over in different directions. Someone like Rusty Bernstein, who is ex-Springbok Legion, he becomes a defendant in Rivonia trial. Some of them joined the armed struggle, joined MK. Some of them became members of parliament, like Louis Kane Berman. Others just decided they're disillusioned and they leave politics altogether. And Saylor stays on as president of 1953-54. And he never liked politics. He had a well-developed bullshit detector, so he was never going to be a good politician. He doesn't like it. He's not interested in power, although he's asked to run for parliament. He says, no, sorry. He's also a bit blunt for some people's taste. And he also, sadly, he starts showing signs of Parkinson's. So he quits politics and he goes back to his farm in Kimberley.
And then passes away 10 years later?
Yeah, so what happens, he goes back to Benfontein and he has problems with his balance and his speech. And again, Harry Oppenheimer says, listen, get a second opinion. Let's get you help. And he goes to a clinic in Joburg and they say it's probably Parkinson's. He goes to the UK where he sits in the Spitfire for the last time. He has a reunion with 74 Squadron. And they tell him, wrongly, it might be an inflammation of the brain. It's related to your wartime service, which definitely played a role in it. And there's this heartbreaking line. There's this interview with a British paper. And he says, it might not be Parkinson's. Now I will really live. And 3 years later, he's dead. So he returns to South Africa, and they confirm the diagnosis. And he becomes the last hero of his life. He was basically invalid on his farm.
What drove you to almost have this obsessive interest in him?
Well, I just think he was an extraordinary human being, whether I'm related to him or not. But he's a very relatable hero because he came from a very poor family. He had all these twists and turns in his life. But whenever he was also step up to the plate, he did. That quote from Marcus Aurelius, waste no time arguing what a good man should be one. That was very much him. And also, he never backed away from fights, and he felt an acute sense of responsibility to act, whether it was joining the RAF or joining the Torch Commander, that whole thing of, if not now, when, if not me, who? He felt that very acutely. He had an incredible moral compass that he followed, no matter what. And I just think that he didn't come from privilege. He didn't, like someone like Brom Fischer, go to Oxford, or didn't have any of those opportunities in life. But he knew right from wrong, and he felt a responsibility to act. And I think that's the kind of role model we need in South Africa, because he's the everyman hero.
Is that why the Brits love him so much? Because of that everyman kind of hero? Or is it just because he shot down a lot of Germans?
Well, that helps, I think. Never hurts. But he was, if you talk to people who knew him, and I've had a great privilege to meet a few of them, including his last close personal friend who passed away last year, Dr. Crispian Trace, who said he was just incredible. He was kind, he was brave, he lived to his standard and inspired other people to do the same thing. And he was a relatable hero. He was not someone who came a superhero. He was just an extraordinary kind man and funny, apparently. He got a good sense of humor. And if you look at the trajectory of his life, what are the odds of a boy born in Wellington becoming friends of Churchill? It's just an extraordinary life, and that's because of his character. And I think that's something we need to talk more about, is the idea of character. And character matters, and moral courage matters. And he's an absolute shining example, not just of the theory of moral courage, but the practice of it. Of never always turn and face the attack and never walk away from injustice you can do something about.
You know, there's some of us who would believe, not that it was preordained, but because we all have a choice, but that there was some higher purpose to his life. Because as you say, little boy from Wellington who's his parents lose the farm. He ends up as a cadet on a very tough upbringing. And yet, almost every step of the way. I remember a headhunter once saying to me, I know that this person should be working here because it's all in the CV. And if you look at all in the CV, it seems like Salim Alon's life and where he ended up. He almost needed to go through those stages. Do you think that's a fair comment?
I think it is, because, like I said, if the father doesn't lose the form, he doesn't go to Simonstown. If he doesn't go to Simonstown, he never visits a bigger world. He probably stays stuck in South Africa. He never comes in contact with what's going on in Germany. If the RAF doesn't change the age requirements, he never goes to the RAF. There were always little twists and turns, but it's also indicative of his character that he was willing to make those choices. And it's also an example of the power of agency, that he's not a victim in all of this. You know, he could have easily turned around and said, I have a really tough life, you know, I'm going back to South Africa. But he says, no, this battle is my battle as well. And he does that in Europe, and he does it when he comes back to South Africa. Like I said, if he had decided to sit out the Torch Commander episode, no one availed it against him. But it's just not, that's not what his character dictates. And I think it's also, his story is also, sorry, the story of the importance of character.
Why don't most South Africans know who Salim Alon was?
Well, firstly, he was written out of history by the National Party very quickly and very efficiently. And can I talk about his funeral? Because I think that's telling. When he dies in 63, he's 50 years old. And, well, firstly, he's not religious, so they had to find a church to bury him from. And St. Cyprian's Cathedral steps up. But then the National Party, the government says, you won't have a military funeral. And they said to all military service members, if you go to the funeral, you can ask permission, you won't get it. If you do go, you won't have a job when you get back. The South African Air Force tried to send a reef. They were prevented from doing so. But then something extraordinary happens, and very few people know about this, but the military attaché at the US embassy, we'd never met Salim. He goes to the ambassador and said, we need to honor this man. And remember, this is 63. This is just before the start of the Rivonia trial. The first political detainee has just died in police custody. These are very dark times.
Yeah, 2 years after the Republic.
Yeah. He goes to the ambassador's a bit, not sure this is a hill I'm going to die on. But he persists, and they send two people in full uniform to the funeral in Kimberley.
Two Americans.
And the mayor of Kimberley gives him a full civic funeral, which is the highest honor they get to stone him. And because the Americans go, the RAF also sends people. And what then Royal Rhodesian Air Force does the same. So if you look at photos of the funeral, there are six people in uniform. Not one of them are South African. But it's extraordinary what that military attaché did, was to take a stand. So because he had a very muted funeral, in 2023, a few of us had a plan to go up to Kimberley for the 60th anniversary of his death. And the thing just snowballed. So thanks to the extraordinary group of people in Kimberley, the McGregor Museum, Salt Park University, St. Cyprian's Cathedral again, the South African Air Force Association, specifically retired Lieutenant Colonel Christa De Toey, Dr. David Morris from St. Cyprian's McGregor, Sunette Swanepoel, McGregor Museum. We all, Mr. Richard Harding, we all came together. The Kimberley Regiment Pipe Band was there. If you've ever heard them, they're quite something. And so about 16 organizations placed a reef on his grave. And the South African Air Force would finally place a reef. The 74 Squadron sent a reef, RAF Club, all these people were prevented in 63. And the American ambassador was there as well. And the US military attaché, just like in 63. So he finally got kind of the send-off he should have had. And one of the best parts was the scouts and the Landsteins. I didn't know what the Landsteins was until recently. It's like the Afrikaans version of the scouts. They were the honor guard, holding the national flag and holding the standards of the General Botha training ship. And the kids were born nearly 50 years after he passed away, of all races, being the honor guard at his grave. And I think that would have meant the absolute world to sail. So.
Not for the first time, I'm proud of the Scots. Let's have a few. Is there anybody who wants to ask any question? David.
I watched a video when I saw this was coming up, and I saw that there was made reference to the king's favorite Afrikaner. I know he also did some training of the British pilots as well as the American pilots. Maybe you can elaborate.
The American pilots, they were still the Army Air Corps. It was before the American Air Force was founded. So partly to protect Sailor, they sent him away to go train pilots, and especially tactics. So there are quite a few stories about what he got up to. He scared the bejesus out of them with dogfights and things. But he was a very popular figure in the States. And if you see the photos of him around D-Day with the Ray-Bans, that's where he got the Ray-Bans from. But also, just an aside, one of the people who went with him, one of the pilots, obviously Sailor's real name was Adolf Gijsbert. He called himself John. He never called himself Adolf, even before the war, just disclaimer. But they would needle him by introducing to American audiences Adolf, and he would just lose it. So.
And the king's favorite Afrikaner?
Yeah, that was a bit of propaganda, because he had an English-born mother, so he was Afrikaner light, I guess. But the British press kind of handed up, especially to encourage people from the Commonwealth to join. But also for the entire war, he wore a tab on his shoulder that said South Africa. So he was always quite clear about where his loyalties lay. So.
Nobody else watched movies ahead of this. Rory?
I'd just like, with the Von's permission, to stand and raise a glass to the memory of Sailor Malala.
So if any of you are interested in learning more about Sailor, on the 13th of September, 11 o'clock, Royal Cape Yard Club, is the third Sailor Malan Memorial Lecture. And our speaker is Lieutenant General retired Carlo Gagliano, who was former head of the South African Air Force. And this year is also the 85th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. So the following day, on the Sunday, 10 o'clock, South African Naval Museum Chapel in Simonstown, we will have a Battle of Britain Sunday service. Everybody's welcome. There will be more details on Facebook. If you follow me on Twitter, plug for me, OxfordBlue7 on Twitter, we'll post more information. I'll also forward it to you. We had a full house last year. Our speaker was the Mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis. And just a side note, in 2023, the City of Cape Town awarded Sailor Civic Honours, which is just below Freedom of the City. And it was the first time he's been honoured in South Africa. So I think it's time, with all these cabinet ministers coming tomorrow, I think we need to push for a national award. No pressure, Alex.
The one I don't think you're going to have any disputes in this audience. The relevance of his life and what he achieved for South Africa today, you hinted at.
I think it's, regardless of where you come from, you can do something, you can act. And I was always, like I said again, always turn and face the attack. No matter who you are or where you are, you can do something. You're not without agency. Everybody of us can make a difference. And I think try to live to his motto, which was, I fear no man. And that is kind of a rising concept. We can't all be fearless, but we can all fear less. And I think that's an example of his life, is to go into battle and to do what is right regardless of the consequences. And that was just to have a moral compass like he did, which is a rare, rare thing. And we can't all live up to his example. But I think it should always point us in the right direction. So,
did he, when he passed, was he despondent? Was he disillusioned?
I think he was very realistic about change South Africa would take decades, because he was surrounded by people who said, no, this is going to, including people in the Springbok Legion, who said, no, this is going to be over in 5 minutes, don't worry about it. So he foresaw it will take years, it will take a heavy price, people pay a heavy price for it, and what happens then? That worried him. And he was very worried about the prospect of armed struggle because of what it would unleash in the country. But even when he started losing his voice, even 61, I think, was his last interview, he was still speaking out. And Torch Commando had disbanded by then. He was still speaking out because journalists would still ask him for comments, and he never shut up. So I think had he had lived, he would have become a problem, possibly to the government. I don't know. But he was very outspoken, and he never, even when he realized he was dying, he never shut up. Always didn't face the attack. So.
And the relationship with Harry Oppenheimer, how did that end?
Well, they remained close friends to his dying day. And if you look at, they had two sets of pallbearers at the funeral. The one set was the military attachés who came, and the others were people from De Beers. He worked for. So, and Harry Oppenheimer is very visible in that photo, and he's clearly upset. So they remained friends for the rest of his life, and they were extraordinarily close friends. I mean, Crispian Trace, who was his last close friend, who passed away, said to me that the two of them were like naughty schoolboys when they're together. And it's extraordinary if you look at it, the vastly different backgrounds they came from, but that shared experience of war, and also they were both men of principle.
It's interesting that you make reference to Harry Oppenheimer's war record in Michael Carter's biography of him. He unpacks it quite well. Perhaps you could share a little bit of your understanding of what Harry actually did in the war?
Well, he was one of two brothers, and the one brother passed away, so he was the heir to the empire. So his father was quite keen to keep him away from the conflict. And because he was influential, he could have had him counting paperclips somewhere. But Harry was very adamant that he wanted to be in combat and not hide behind his privilege. So he was in tank regiment in the war and saw quite a lot of action. And I think that's one of the reasons that Saylor respected him so much, because Saylor, all his brothers fought in the war. He had a brother, Rolf, who was the second oldest. He joined the South African Air Force, was killed in action. He had a brother, Francis, who joined the Royal Air Force, also a Spitfire pilot, killed in action. He had a brother, Stanley, who joined, decided, I'm not going up in the aircraft, stayed on the ground, joined the Union Army, was severely wounded, and then became a POW. And the youngest brother was training in the RAF, but then the war ended. And his mother lied about her age and joined the war effort in some way. So there's a great article, and I think it's in the London Times, The Fighting Milans, about this entire family getting stuck in. So I think that shared history he had with Harry, he very much respected him. And also, I don't think anyone else would have been able to convince Saylor to lead the Torch Commando except Harry Oppenheimer.
Thank you, Yvonne. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh la la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence, renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise. Our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.